Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Jonathan Tepperman, author of The Fix: How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline, published in September by Tim Duggan Books. Jonathan is the managing director of Foreign Affairs magazine and has spent almost 20 years working on international affairs as an editor, writer, and analyst. He's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, The New Republic, and many others. The Fix is a book that acknowledges that we are in a boatload of trouble, but that there have been some good examples of countries that have figured something out and have worked assiduously to put those fixes in places. Brazil, Canada, Indonesia, Rwanda are countries that Jonathan showcases with regards to those fixes. Through a combination of intelligence, a clear-headed view towards the absence of corruption, and a singular desire to create a lively and growing economy, along with a moral awareness of its purposes and of its community, these nations have gone against the grain of what is bad in the world today. Hopefully, Jonathan is right, but with what is happening today in this last election cycle, what we read about every day in our newspapers, our news feed, what we see on our televisions, in some ways, the fix may be a hard sell for many of you, or some of you. But I think after listening to Jonathan today, we might have a new viewpoint on these things. So welcome, Jonathan, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show, and thanks for setting my challenge out the way that you've done. I now know the task that I have ahead of me on the show.
I know. I'm one of those readers, so yes, this will be an interesting dialogue. If I go through it really quickly, you've talked about Brazil, Canada, Indonesia, Rwanda, Singapore, Botswana, the United States a couple of times, South Korea, and Mexico. So we can't do all of them, so let's concentrate on a few. And if we get right into it, one of the interesting ones you talk about is Canada and this idea of how it's, because of its past presidencies, how it's, and its current one for that matter, how it's been able to embrace an idea of multiculturalism, especially, again, against the contrast of this last election cycle in America.
Right, right. So the way the book is structured is each chapter, there are 10, tells the story of how one country around the world has successfully tackled one great political or economic problem that most places, most people think are insurmountable or unsolvable. And it's that sense that these problems have no answers that has led to this great pessimism that so many people share today about the state of the world and the direction in which we're heading. And it's that pessimism that gave rise to the kind of populism that fueled the candidacy of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and Brexit voters in the UK and the rise of populists and xenophobes throughout Europe, et cetera, et cetera. The chapter on Canada tells the story of how one country has gotten immigration right, and so spectacularly so that it should solve as a, it serve, I think, serve as a model for other countries. Canada today is probably the most immigration-friendly country in the world. Its annual per capita immigration rate is about double that of the United States, and its percentage of foreign-born residents is again about double that of the United States, and also countries like Germany and Sweden, which we think of as being friendly towards immigration. And yet, what makes Canada particularly interesting is at this political moment when we see all of this populism, this xenophobia, and this backlash against immigration in so many countries, is that none of that is occurring in Canada. In a year when Canada just accepted the most immigrants it ever has in its history, and three times more Syrian refugees than the United States has, even though Canada only has a tenth of the total population, Canadians couldn't be happier about immigration. In fact, in a poll taken a couple of years ago, they ranked multiculturalism, which, as many of your listeners will know, is a dirty word in a lot of places, including parts of the United States. They ranked multiculturalism as the second thing they're most proud of in terms of what it means to be a Canadian, ahead of hockey, by the way. And you know, when Canadians put anything ahead of hockey, it's a big deal.
Yep.
But what I find even more interesting about the Canada story is that Canada didn't start out this way. As recently as the 1960s, Canada was a racist, parochial country with a almost entirely either Indigenous or European based population, and an immigration policy that explicitly forbade people with any pigment in their skin. And so the question that preoccupied me as I was writing the chapter is, how did that Canada, which was as nasty places as you could be found, become the extraordinarily successful multicultural wonderland of Canada today? And the answer is that the Canadian government did two really important things right. The first thing was to shift its immigration policy in the mid-1960s from one that focused entirely on country of origin to one that focused on economic criteria instead. So it dropped all racial criteria, and it instead put in place a 9-point system that looked at things like, did you speak English or French? What was your, what were your level of education? What were the job skills that you could bring to Canada? And by shifting the focus of the immigration system in that way, the Canadian government ensured that its new immigrant population would start contributing in a very immediate way to the economic well-being of the country. That immigrants would have this material benefit that not just they but all Canadians would enjoy. They would start new businesses that would employ native-born Canadians. They would contribute to the country through academia or in all sorts of other ways. They would take jobs that native-born Canadians might not want to take themselves. The other thing that Canada did was, in 1971, explicitly adopt this policy of official multiculturalism. It was the first country in the world that did so. And that involved a couple of things. One was spending a lot of money to promote the integration of newcomers, but the other was spending a lot of money to promote the idea that pluralism and diversity made Canada more Canadian and not less. And these two policies ended up working together and reinforcing one another, because on the one hand, Canadians were seeing the material benefits of immigration, and on the other hand, they were getting this strong PR message from their government that immigration and pluralism made their country stronger. And it was these two influences together that produced the what's now called the Canadian exception, the fact that Canada is really the only Western developed country that has continued to embrace immigration so wholeheartedly, and where immigration is not just popular, but a bipartisan cause supported by conservatives as well as by liberals.
And the reason why I question, how great is this, is because I go, on a micro scale, if you will, yes, Canada has done that, but how can you possibly expect to expand that experiment, that successful experiment, to the rest of the world or to America,
right,
which it seems almost impossible?
Right. Well, that's really the key question, because as you say, if it only worked in Canada, that's very nice for them, but what good does it do for the rest of us? There are two sort of challenges that the Canadian model has to overcome when you're thinking about applying it to the United States. First is, as you say, Canada, although it's geographically vast, is in population terms much smaller than the U.S. It's, as I mentioned earlier, just a tenth of the size. The second is that Canada has much less of a problem with illegal immigration, with undocumented migrants, than does the United States. And that's because of the good fortune of its geography. It happens to have two huge oceans on its left and its right, an Arctic wasteland to its north, and the United States to its south, which until now has not produced that many immigrants. What all of that means is that the percentage of Canada's immigrant population that is undocumented is tiny. It's about 3 to 6% compared to over 10%. I think the figure is more like 13% in the United States. But the comparison that I would draw here is to the United Kingdom, and the reason I do so is because that really emphasizes the role that government policies can play in affecting people's attitudes. So the UK is an island, as everybody knows, but that means, of course, that it's surrounded by water, which everybody knows, but that means that it has the same, enjoys the same kind of geographic isolation that Canada does, and as a consequence, it has the very same level of undocumented migrants as does Canada, again, 3 to 6%. And yet, public opposition to immigration is twice as high in the UK as it is in Canada, and that's because the government hasn't done all of the things, the smart things to integrate immigrants, to ensure that they pay material dividends, that they make the country stronger economically, and to convince ordinary Britons of the fact. So what does that all mean for the United States? Well, a lot, as it happens. The model that we currently use in the United States to shape our immigrant policy is what's known as family reunification. So most people who get into the United States get in because they have a relative already in the country. And that sounds appealing on a sort of emotional level. But the problem with that is it lets what's basically an arbitrary factor, that is, did your uncle or father or grandfather or sister have the good luck or dumb luck to get into the country before you did, it lets that shape our entire or the majority of our immigrant population. The Canadian approach is much more rational, and there's really no reason that the United States couldn't shift to a more rational approach like Canada does. Of course, there would still be a constituency demanding that we continue to let some people in under family reunification, and we could, as Canada does, by the way, but there's no reason that we can't emphasize economic criteria more than we currently do, and it's my strong conviction that were we to do that, it would quickly start to weaken the opposition to migration that exists in the United States today.
Yeah, but the problem is that your arguments are based on logic, because you're a logical and intelligent person. In the United States now, we're dealing with populism. And in
right.
England, notwithstanding the economic detriment of Brexit, it
right.
succeeded because populists simply did not want immigrants in that country. And so
yeah.
notwithstanding the fact that every argument you make makes perfect sense, you have to deal with the actual social aspects of it and the psychology of the country in which you're dealing.
Exactly, and that was very well said. And what that means is that immigration reform alone can't be the entire solution. Because, yes, people are expressing opposition to immigration today, and yes, they're expressing opposition to trade pacts today, it's all of the things that fueled the Trump campaign. But if you look closely at those voters, what they're really, at the end of the day, most concerned about is their own economic insecurity. The fact that as the
yeah.
world has changed in the last 20 years and our economy has become increasingly globalized, people, some segment of the population, and these are the folks who traditionally held down manufacturing jobs, which used to earn them a good living even though they didn't have college education, they no longer have the kind of lifestyle and the kind of economic security that they once enjoyed. In fact, they become much more insecure. And for decades now, our politicians have been promising that they're going to address that problem, and they haven't done it. And so we're never going to stuff the populist bottle, genie back into the bottle. We're never going to kill that dragon unless politicians finally start making the kind of moves that would address the underlying causes of this great irrational populism that you just identified. And that means helping people adjust to the changes in the economy by doing things to emphasize vocational education, for example, by helping workers, mid-career workers, get the kind of skills that they need to compete. To manufacturing in the traditional sense, a lot of it has left the United States, but a lot of manufacturing on a slightly higher tech level is coming back to the United States.
True.
The trick is, if you only have a traditional high school education, you can't get those kind of jobs, because it's not about operating a lathe in a machine shop anymore. Now you need to know how to run the computers that run the machines. Well, that doesn't take a college degree, but it does take some kind of vocational training. And we could be much better in this country about providing that education than we are today.
So if we, let's table that for a moment, and let's assume that it's a possibility. And I, even when Rand Paul in one of the first debates talked about, you know, there's nothing wrong with being a welder, I really agreed with that statement. I mean,
sure.
And in fact, it's a good job to have. You make a lot of money, and just by not going to college doesn't really mean anything to me. So yes, I agree with that. But let's move on to one of your other countries, and I'm going to get slightly graphic on this one, which is Rwanda. And if you look in the past 20 years, you have this horrible genocide, and you have the situation in which, for example, on a scale of hundreds of thousands of people, you might have a situation where a husband has his arms chopped off by a machete, and he watches his wife have the same thing happen to her while he watches her being raped, and then he's killed. And you have this happening to scores of millions of people. And in your chapter on Rwanda, you're talking about the courts that have evolved since that horrible tragedy and a new government that is enforcing, sometimes in a draconian fashion, some type of justice. And you specifically state that while this is not a perfect system, it's an improvement, which of course it's an improvement over the genocide, but is it enough of an improvement for you to actually call it one of your fixes? That's where I took issue.
Right. So that's a really, really good question. The story of Rwanda, the chapter on Rwanda, is the story of a country that somehow managed to put itself back together after one of the, if not the most hideous civil war of the 20th century. In 1994, one segment of the Rwandan population, the ethnic Hutus, tried to liquidate the other portion of the population who were known as Tutsis. And they almost succeeded. And anywhere between 800,000 and 1 million people were killed in the course of about 3 months, many of them, as you say, by machetes. And yet Rwanda today is, in many senses, a high-functioning state where there is almost no violence, where things like, on all sorts of economic indicators, it's doing really well. It's one of the least corrupt states in Africa. Education is universal. Healthcare is universal. So things like child mortality, infant mortality, maternal mortality, all these things have dropped dramatically. The population is much healthier. And in many ways, Rwanda, in all these human development issues, is now the envy of its neighbors. It also is a place where it's pretty hard to imagine Hutus and Tutsis starting to kill one another again on a massive scale. Now, there's a big problem, or question mark, or an asterisk next to the Rwanda model, which is that in recent years especially, the guy who made all this happen, who's the same guy who led the army of Tutsis that ended the civil war back in 94, whose name is Paul Kagame, has become increasingly authoritarian. And having promised after two terms that he would step down, he recently announced that he was going to run for a third term. And having imposed a lot of restrictions on things like free speech in the media in the early days after the Civil War, when those restrictions, you know, arguably were legitimate because you had a country that was so badly traumatized, he has maintained those restrictions today when there's less justification for them. Nonetheless, you know, I think Rwanda is really important to look at for the simple reason that we have a number of really big, scary wars currently being waged around the country, around the world, I should say, that are all internal wars. So Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. As implausible as it may be, or may seem, all those wars are going to end at some point. And unless we have a good model for putting countries back together again, the fighting will probably resume soon after it stops. And so as a world, we need to figure out a way for preventing that. And Rwanda, I argue in that chapter, despite Kagame's flaws, does offer a pretty good model for that. Now, what Rwanda did is, I mean, it did a few things. First is the Kagame stopped the fighting. The second is he focused heavily on economic development, as I said earlier. Third, he outlawed any discussion of racial difference. There was no longer going to be any more talk about who was Tutsi, who was Hutu. Everyone was just going to be Rwandan. He banned those terms from government documents and from identity cards, etc. And then the fourth thing that he did was he created a system to provide justice, because after the war, I mean, Rwanda didn't have a great system of justice before the war, but by the end of it, it was completely eliminated. There had been 800 judges in the country before the war. 50 of them survived. By the year 2000, 6 years after the war, there were about 200,000 war criminals in jail. Rwanda only had 13 jails at the time. These people were packed in so tight that they were dying in droves, and yet the court system was so shattered that it was estimated that it would take 200 years to process all of these people through ordinary courts. But Rwanda couldn't just let them go, because that would spark a whole new round of fighting. And so what Kagame and his government did, in consultation with experts from a lot of other countries, is they set up a system that was based on a traditional indigenous system of justice in Rwanda, a tribal system that dated from the pre-colonial times, which was known as Gacaca, which is a Kinyarwanda word that means justice in the grass. And these were essentially village tribunals that were staffed not by trained legal professionals, but by local people who were respected in the communities. They set up 12,000 of these around the country, and these started hearing cases. Some of the big differences between them and Western courts is anybody could talk, anybody had standing, and they emphasized reconciliation rather than punishment, so that if the accused made a full confession, they got a greatly reduced sentence, and they were generally given community service. And what all of that did was help to reintegrate a lot of the former killers into Rwandan society, and it also cleared through the backlog of cases pretty quickly. Now, was everybody happy with the system? No. Were most people happy with the system? No. Everybody had some grievances with it, but there were a couple of really smart things that Kagame did. And those things, I think, are the lessons that we should learn, because we can't, you know, because Rwanda's system was based on Rwanda's history, it obviously wouldn't work in its particulars in another country, but the sort of larger lessons would. And those were, number one, not to give everybody anything, not to, as I say in the book, he didn't choose to please some of the people all of the time, which is to say, to give one constituency everything that they wanted. Because that would be a way of just ensuring more conflict in the future. Because if you give some people everything they want, you're guaranteeing that a whole other portion of the population is going to be disgruntled. So he split the difference. You could sort of call it the politics of satisficing, where everybody got some of what they needed, but nobody got everything. And that left everybody grumbling, but everybody got just enough that they were willing to buy into the new system, because they saw that it was better than the fighting that went before. And Kagame also recognized that local problems need local solutions, and that you can't just use a model that was adopted or created somewhere else, like the international or the Western-based court tradition, in a country that has no similar tradition. And so it's those kind of lessons, I think, that can be applied to other countries, whether it's Sri Lanka, which ended its civil war now about 5 or 6 years ago, or to places like Yemen or Syria, which are currently at war, but someday in the future are going to stop fighting, and then are going to have to deal with all of the crimes and traumas of their past.
Okay, well, I'll end that section by saying the solution just seems to me to be slightly Machiavellian, and I'll leave it at that. And then,
well, I don't agree with you. I mean, I don't disagree with you. It is Machiavellian, absolutely. But the point that I make in the chapter in Rwanda and in some of the others as well is that these are messy, morally complicated solutions in some of these cases. But the alternative in every one of these cases was much worse, and that was either to keep on doing what the countries had been doing, or to try for some sort of utopian ideal that would never have worked. So what these and a lot of the other countries in the book did is they didn't let the great or the perfect be the enemy of the good. And they came up with a messy, imperfect, but pragmatic solution that did more to solve the problems than probably any other solution would have done under those circumstances.
Okay, let's segue to Botswana, a country that is in a complete mess, worst country in the world. All of a sudden, it finds it's sitting on a hill of rocks, which are diamonds. All of a sudden, it doesn't know what to do with them. Much like all of a sudden, for no reason at all, Saudi Arabia finds itself the richest country in the world, where you can get $100,000 a year and you don't have to work and you get health care and all this. But Botswana, and here's the Machiavellian part for me in Botswana, they end up being partners with De Beers, which in my mind, De Beers is like the nastiest company in the entire world, from blood diamonds on to cutting workers' hands off to doing full body cavity searches to fixing the prices of diamonds. And yet Rwanda has done wonderfully because it found the diamonds and it's used that wealth to create a country that's unparalleled in its success in a short period of time. But they're holding hands very tightly with De Beers, and that's the part that bothers me. So what do you say to that?
So, right, as you say, in the mid-1960s, when Botswana became independent, it was one of the poorest and most miserable places on Earth. In fact, it had been so poor in the preceding decades that the British, who were happy to colonize most of Africa, didn't really want anything to do with it. And they only got involved in Botswana when the Botswanans actually invited them to come because they were afraid of encroachment from the Boers in South Africa.
Tell about that cartoon.
Right. So there's this famous cartoon from Botswana's independence that appeared, I think, in Punch magazine, where the pictures a British colonial officer wearing his pith hat and his mustache walking away from Botswana and saying, "Don't worry, you'll be fine." And you see Botswana is depicted as this small, malnourished baby sitting on a turf of arid ground. And surrounding him is a lion with the word South Africa on it and a snake with the word Rhodesia on it and a vulture with the name of another one of Botswana's neighbors, because these were all white racist regimes at the time that were determined not to let a black-ruled country in their midst survive.
So, all right, so I interrupted you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So, yeah, Botswana gets off to this incredibly inauspicious start, and then a year after independence, something happens which sounds like it might be a good thing, but in most developing countries has turned out to be a disaster, which is the country discovers vast natural resources. In this case, the largest diamond mines at that point ever discovered, and mines that have made Botswana in the years since the mid-1960s, the largest diamond exporter in the world by value. In fact, one of its mines alone, the Arapa mine that I visited, produces 2 metric tons of diamonds every year.
Wow.
So extraordinary wealth. Now, the problem with that kind of wealth is that, especially in new, poor countries, it tends to, and whether it comes in the form of oil or whatever, it tends to produce huge amounts of corruption. It tends to produce really bad governance. It even tends to destroy the economy, because why invest in things like schools and education and infrastructure when you can just pull money out of the ground? So Botswana managed to avoid all of those problems. The way it did it was by the unsexy essential rules of good governance. It set up a democratic, transparent system where power was shared. No one individual could control the money or could control all the levers of government. Everybody had a say. It was this remarkably flat and transparent system, and that ensured clean governance, lack of corruption, good policymaking. But as you say, Botswana, the way it was able to take advantage and exploit its wealth was in partnership with this country that, for a lot of people, has a bad reputation, De Beers, which is based or was based at the time in neighboring South Africa. Now, in some ways that's a complicated relationship, but Botswana has done extraordinarily well by its partnership with De Beers. There's none of the kind of abuse that you were describing in the Botswanan mines, which are run in cooperation with De Beers, but overseen by the Botswanan government. And the Botswanan government has proved to be such an incredibly tough-minded and savvy negotiator, despite the fact that, remember, when the country got independence and from Britain, you know, it had a tiny population with virtually no experience, and they were sitting down at the table with these Western-educated, generally British or South African, international, multinational titans of industry. And yet, the Botswanans have managed over the years to, for example, increase the proportion, the split of the resources from their mines that they get versus what De Beers get from 10% in the mid-1960s to about 81% today. So they have managed to use De Beers to their own purposes, get what they need and what the country and their people need from De Beers while preventing the kind of abuses that are seen in other countries.
And I like the way that you have that that point about the De Beers executive saying, I don't like what they do, but they have never been less than logical in their arguments.
Right. Yeah, we had this fascinating conversation in Gaborone, which is the capital of Botswana. And Gaborone is this fairly tidy, middle-class-looking African city, but it's a bit drab. And then you go to De Beers headquarters, which is this ultra-high-tech, massive glass and steel sci-fi fortress on the outskirts of town, with unbelievable security. You have to pass through microwave and x-ray scanners on both your way in and your way out. And inside the sparkling air-conditioned interior, I met with the one of the current heads of De Beers, who said, they make me crazy at times, but he had this obvious sort of grudging respect for just how shrewd negotiators they'd always been. And, you know, he had to confess that they were, at the end of the day, fair, because not only did they get what they wanted, but De Beers still did well by the deals as well.
Yeah, and that changes my mind quite a bit on Botswana, especially if De Beers is actually doing the things that you say they're doing by the mandate of Botswana. But that also brings me to another one, and I like to move, you know, I'm enjoying moving through these, is with the United States and with fracking, for example, which I'm totally against, whether it's illogically that I'm against it, whether I've listened, whether I've drank the Kool-Aid or not. But I don't like the idea. I think it's environmentally insensitive. I think there's all kinds of things wrong with it. But you embrace, I won't say embrace, but you talk about fracking in a positive way. And you're also talking about the continuation of our use of fossil fuels and saying that they're going to last for a long time now and that gas is much cleaner than coal. And that all sounds well and good, but is it actually true?
Well, it is true that natural gas, burning natural gas, is cleaner than coal. It produces about a third as much methane and carbon dioxide and other pollutants as does burning coal. It's also much cleaner than burning oil. So this is, again, one of these cases of, I think, not letting the great be the enemy of the good. So I absolutely agree that the goal, the long-term goal, should be getting the United States and other countries around the world off burning carbon entirely. But that's not going to happen overnight. And in the meantime, there are measures that we can take to reduce the amount of carbon that we burn and the pollutants that we emit. And switching from oil and coal to natural gas is one way to do it. That's especially attractive at a time when prices are as low as they are today. It also happens to be the fact that the United States sits on these vast resources, but it's not the only country in the world that does. And China has enormous energy needs. India has enormous energy needs. Now, and many other developing countries do as well. They can continue to do what they're doing now, which is import huge amounts of oil from places like the Middle East, which is doubly bad, right? Because they have to burn oil to get the oil to China or to India, and then they're burning the oil and the coal itself, which is, again, really, really dirty. Or they can develop their own natural gas resources, which they haven't been able to do yet. And the way to do that is fracking. Now, fracking, as you've identified, has a really bad reputation in some precincts in the United States. And I think some of that is deserved and some of it isn't. The part that is deserved, so you hear about some of the most common fears associated with fracking are that it causes earthquakes, that it poisons the water table, that it releases methane into the air. Fracking, when done badly, has the potential to do all of those things. But fracking, when done properly, doesn't do any of those things. And in fact, much of, for example, the earthquake problem that oil-rich states like Oklahoma are suffering from right now, that actually has nothing to do with fracking. That's about conventional oil drilling techniques and not fracking. But you know, the reason I think that fracking has gotten such a bad reputation is because companies haven't done everything that they should to safeguard the process, to make sure it's done as safely and cleanly as possible. And that's in part because the government has not been as scrupulous as it should be about creating and enforcing regulations. Now, that's starting to change, and the Obama administration has done a lot to impose new guidelines on industry, which are bringing things around. And a lot of people that I talk to for the chapter, because, of course, I'm not an energy expert myself, but I talk to a lot of energy experts and also environmentalists, like the head of the Environmental Defense Fund, who, you know, is not exactly a shill for the oil and gas industry, who said that, yeah, fracking can be done cleanly if the government supervises it sufficiently and ensures that companies that are doing it have the right safeguards in place. And the Obama administration, to its credit, has done a lot to try and impose those kinds of safeguards. It's had to do it on its own because Congress won't cooperate. So it's done it through the kind of executive orders that have outraged Republicans, but it's had to resort to those because Congress won't take up the issues or wouldn't take up the issue itself.
It's funny because I hardly ever, well, actually, I never agree with Republicans, but I did listen to something that Marco Rubio said one time, and if I took all my moral compunctions out of it, what he said was exactly right. And he said, I think something like he does believe in climate change, but he feels like with regard to our economy, the things we would have to do to change that in the United States would be so expensive, and nothing we could do would even begin to touch the pollution that China and India will generate in the next generation. And I thought about it, and it makes perfect sense. But yet at the same time, it's morally reprehensible. That's how
right.
I feel. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And that's why Rubio's argument is a powerful one. But where I differ from it is that he uses it as an excuse for doing nothing. And
right.
I don't accept that. What you know, I think it's important to recognize that moving to a clean, cleaner energy economy would have some negative consequences. It would put, you know, for example, a lot of people who work in the oil and gas industry out of work. And it might make energy in the short term more expensive. And similarly, it's true that the United States cannot on its own reduce global warming and fight climate change because the Chinese economy is already much dirtier than ours, and China's already the number one emitter. And until the Chinese start making reductions or greater reductions than they already are, the problem isn't going to go away. But that's no excuse for us not acting on our own, number one, and doing more than we are. And number two, the United States has been trying. The great problem, this is what's known in political science as the as a free rider problem or a collective action problem. It's how do you get everybody around the world, when you have a problem like climate change that requires vast cooperation, and yet the problem is, if we don't do anything about it, we're not going to feel the problem today or tomorrow. It's going to be something that future generations have to deal with. How do you, excuse me, get countries to cooperate? And how do you get some countries to cooperate if other countries, who are a big part of the problem, are not going to get involved? And in part, you know, the reason that they don't want to cooperate is because they make the argument, and it has a lot of merit to it, frankly, that, hey, the United States got to pollute with no challenge for 150 years throughout its industrial development. And they got rich for many, 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 many years by burning oil and gas and coal. And now, all of a sudden, they're already rich, and they're preaching to us that we need to get clean immediately. Why? How is that fair? Why shouldn't we get the years to burn dirty but cheap fuel to power our economy, and then once we're rich, start talking about getting clean? And that's a problem that needs to get addressed. But again, none of this is an excuse for not doing anything. And there's a lot that the United States can do unilaterally. Again, the Obama administration has tried to do a lot on its own. It's been stymied by Congress. It's been stymied by the courts. And there's also stuff that can be done on a bilateral, if you can't do it on a multilateral basis. So again, the U.S. has worked out a couple of major climate deals, one-on-one with China, which are really important because it shows, number one, that you can make progress. And number two, you're getting, not all of the world's polluters on board, but two of the big ones.
You know, it boils down to, and we can end with this question, is, you know, you see it on bumper stickers all over the place, which is think globally, act locally. And yours is like your book is like a macro of that, which is we should all be thinking globally and acting locally. And what you're saying is learning the lessons from these 10 different countries in various aspects of their cultural, social, economic lives, adapting those on an individual basis. But
that's precisely right. And that
it's hard. It's hard. That's really hard to do.
It is hard to do. But the alternative sometimes is doing nothing, and that's worse. So we as a species face all of these big problems today. And unfortunately, the answers to some of these big problems seem like they're pretty far off. But that doesn't mean that there aren't all kinds of things that we can do in the interim to make a difference. And that's what this book is about, how countries tackled particular problems on their own terms, often in imperfect ways, but in ways that were nonetheless really important because they turned things around and in one area or in lots of areas turned struggling countries into thriving countries. And there are lessons that either in a direct or an indirect way can be learned and applied around the world. And I think if we don't do that, we risk more of the kind of turmoil and seeming decline that we've been suffering in recent years.
Well, you're a very nice person and a very intelligent person. And I hate to say it, but it's true. You actually have changed my mind a little bit today. And I don't like to admit things like that, but it's definitely true.
So, well, thank you for that painful confession.
And your book, because I have an independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, and your book is out front on our nonfiction bestseller table, and it's been selling. And I think one of the reasons why it's been selling, and I have been actually pushing it, as has my bookstore manager, is because you aren't afraid in the beginning of the book to say all the different things that are wrong, and then go on to say, okay, all right, I understand this, you understand this, now let's get to work doing these other things. So I think it's really a great book, and I thank you so much for taking the time today to talk to us.
Well, thank you so much. It was an absolute delight.
We were speaking with Jonathan Tepperman, whose book, The Fix, How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World in Decline, was published in September, before the election, before all of this nonsense. And what's so good about it is that it actually gives us kind of a roadmap, a difficult roadmap, as to how we can affect change that other countries have done successfully. So what they've done on a smaller basis, if we all work together, we actually can make a change. And we could make a big change, and one in which, you know, we would have a world, not, you know, the beauty contestant, all I want is world peace, but we'd go a long way toward increasing our happiness, increasing our social equality, and increasing our cultural awareness, and increasing the efficacies of our economies. So, anyway, join us every week. We have great people coming here to talk to us. Not coming here, but coming here usually by telephone. One of my upcoming guests is Dava Sobel. She's going to be discussing her latest work, which is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And it is just that, a glass universe. There's so many women scientists who did all the grunt work for people who discovered the microwave radiation that gives rise to the remnants of the Big Bang, or discovered cures for polio, or discovered radioactivity in certain elements. And this is about the specific measurement of the stars, their locations, the redshift, the Doppler shift, all that kind of stuff. And they didn't get any credit, and she gives them that credit in this book. And then by that time, by the time hers is broadcast, it'll be close to the end of the year, just in time for the Wellington Square Bookshop Notable Books of 2016 show. One of my favorite shows, because my bookstore manager, Donna, will be here, and we'll be arguing back and forth. And there's nothing I like better than arguing with her, because we have a great deal of fun in doing so. So thanks, as always, for joining us today, listening to Jonathan Tepperman, and we hope you'll be with us next week when we interview Dava Sobel. I'm pretty sure that's who it'll be, or else we'll switch things and do the Notable Books of 2016. So thanks again for joining us here on The Avid Reader.